morning, everyone. I'd like to call to order this meeting of the House Health Committee and note that we're convening the meeting at 8:39 a.m. And members present are Representatives Boyer, Grunberg, Gall, and myself, Representative Ellis. We have two items on today's calendar. We'll be taking House Bill 282 relating to local administration of public schools first, and then House Bill 193, REAA School Board Membership. And the prime sponsor of 282 is with us. Good morning, Representative Copeland, and if you'd like to go ahead and present the bill to the committee.
Good morning, and thank you, Mr. Chairman. Essentially, you have a position paper before you, but I'd like to repeat statements. State finances grow tighter and individual school district expenses grow less predictable, the economic downside of local control appears. We've created 55 separate school districts, each with the authority to create an entire administrative structure, including superintendent, business manager, person, purchasing, etc. In small districts, such expenditures can absorb over 50% of the budget, leaving less for direct classroom services to pupils for whom we have created the schools and the foundation funding program. And I'd like to stress that our responsibility as the legislature directly is not to the school board, not to the teachers, not to the administrators, but to the children for whom we have created the school system. That is the educational responsibility of the state. Other states faced with the same problems have tried a variety of solutions. This proposal preserves the authority and power of each locally elected school board, but permits them to voluntarily join together to provide any given service or services, both to save money or to organize programs no one small district can provide alone. In other states, these arrangements are called union school districts, cooperating school districts, boards of cooperative educational services, etc. And they run the gamut from several districts to jointly hire a superintendent and administrative staff to joint provision of single services such as special education. The bill is drafted to afford the greatest flexibility to local districts in Alaska rather than prejudging the area they may choose to develop programs in. It was my thought that the department and the state board could, through regulation, regularize the different programs that are needed. We do have a programs in special ed that are run this way and some others. Earlier, during the period of federal program funding to a greater extent, there were a number of Title III programs in the state that serve these purposes, but I think we've only got one that was initiated that way any longer. For your light reading and backup, I included a copy of the publication out of Education USA called Shared Services and Cooperatives, which gives you an idea nationally of the types of programs that are run. I've seen the Boards of Cooperative Educational Services in New York State, intermediate school districts in some states, regional service agencies and the like, and was involved, in fact, in setting up several voluntary cooperative programs in the East, including the one around called Metro, around Hartford, Connecticut, the prime purpose of which was to provide the opportunity for integration of the schools in Hartford by transferring students from the ghetto schools to the rural districts and building on that a whole range of cooperative services. Similarly, in the Boston suburbs, we set up a program there, which was successful for the participants, but of course Boston could not resolve its internal problems, unfortunately. And in Rochester, New York, similarly. And I have, of course, compatriots who went through graduate school with me who ended up going through a variety of these. One friend of mine had quite an interesting career in Vermont with some very small school districts that parallel some of the ones in western Alaska. Unfortunately, he was the joint superintendent of seven small school districts, each one of which retained its Yankee independence and insisted on having separate board meetings, so he was going to board meetings every night. Ultimately, he did persuade them to meet in one large meeting.
Representative Coburn, does that complete your presentation?
It's been called to my attention that the drafter did not catch a couple of conflicting statutes, and so the department has some suggestions for an amendment.
Okay, and we'll hear about that in a moment. Representative Grunberg?
Yes, this seems to me, thank you, Mr. Chairman, this seems to me like an excellent idea, but I have one problem. Do you have a copy of the bill here?
Sure, I do.
And it's the language that you want to delete. We right now in my office are trying to work with some of the school districts in the Lower Kuskokwim school district that we visited earlier, mm-hmm. and the Anchorage school district to see about getting an exchange of high school pupils and teachers, where the kids would come in, the high school kids would come into Anchorage for a week or two, and some of the Anchorage students would go out to some of the small villages and maybe even do that for the teachers. And there is a lot of enthusiasm for that. And I sure would, unless you have a real problem, like to keep that language in on lines 14 to 16 and not strike that.
One of the reasons for it, and strike it there, we've struck it there and moved it down to two. You have a general statement, educational services, and then you go, and then the sentence goes on in a very specific, so we made the first section saying educational or administrative services, and then took the definitional part, boarding home, put it down, and included it.
Oh, so there's no intent to change it?
No, it's just trying to make it a little more rational.
That's fine, then I have no objection, and I appreciate it, and my fear level is down. That's my thanks.
Representative Kopanen, I don't know, I'll pose this to you. It may be better answered by the representatives from the department here this morning, but what kind of decision process would be involved, and what kind of what would be the, you know, acceptable underlying rationales for the department requiring a district to cooperate with other districts? What would be the decisional process the department would go through to make that decision to require a school district to cooperate?
Rather than
with
the voluntary cooperation.
Mm-hmm.
That would be up to the department, but what has been done in other states when a school district is either bankrupt or is in such turmoil it cannot operate the school because of factionalism or something like that, or misfeasance or malfeasance on the part of the school board. Some states, for instance, Massachusetts, puts the district in receivership and is operated directly by the State Department of Education. Other states usually then require the services that are, rather than doing that, require it to work with certain other school districts or place them under the temporary control of a neighboring school district. Or they take certain services away and say that would be just done by it. So that would, it would be up to the department to write the regulations, and I think reserving that power to the department, I think, is important in case there is any problem arises. But it's prejudging how they're going to, what problem is going to come, I don't know.
Okay. That your comments get to the second part of my question about what would be the, you know, the acceptable rationales for requiring school districts to come up with these cooperative arrangements. And so you listed bankruptcy. Would just a cost savings, I mean, thinking that the school district is not bankrupt, but just that there's a good cost savings that districts haven't taken advantage of that are pretty easily worked out, would that be a good enough reason to require school districts to change their current arrangements to cooperate?
In the past, the legislature by statute tried to require school districts to expend at least 50% of the budget in, you know, classroom, direct classroom services. A number of school districts were not able to do that. I mean, not a large number, but less than half a dozen. I should think that that would be a reasonable situation. If more than 50% of the budget is being absorbed in services that don't go directly to the student in the classroom, such as provision of teachers, books, et cetera, I think that would be a legitimate case in point. You know, for instance, there
would have been Dillingham and the surrounding school district could jointly have saved about $100,000, we were told a year or two ago, if they provided joint purchasing services. Mm-hmm. They did not do so. We still have the problem of a single-site school district there, Dillingham, which in that case, I think the state could say, likewise, there are a number of single-site school districts in Representative Gall's district that might profit by joint purchasing services, joint warehousing, or even maintenance contracts or other things like that.
Not to mention legal services and half a dozen other things.
Okay, but we're sort of fleshing out a list here, and then when we have the department come up, we'll ask them to comment on each one of them and how they would see this coming together. But we've listed bankruptcy, a cost savings, you know, an unexploited cost savings potential between a couple of districts or more than two.
I think it's really, we have to continue to focus on the services to the children. Mm-hmm. And if those are not being met, that's, I think, is the criteria.
So not enough money going to direct classroom services or right. to kids, in essence, directly. Better, now would one possible, I mean, justifiable reason be that the school district next door has a better, maybe has better test scores in language development in the adjoining district has really poor test scores in that area, and so the department could make a case for sharing of those resources or provision of that kind of program. Or
you mean special services? Mm-hmm. Certainly, that's a possibility. I'd leave it up to the department to discuss
okay.
that.
Well, we'll get their comments then.
But certainly special education is a case in point, because that's a situation where you have a very small number of children having particular disabilities, and that's actually what we do now, is provide those jointly. And you also don't have them consistently. As a child with a particular disability goes through the school system, the need for the teacher with that particular skill or training diminishes, so you may be misusing that teacher if you didn't have them also teach in other areas.
And Representative Coburn, obviously when the bill was drafted, you were comfortable with this title. Have you, it's a title with broad application. Are you still?
I have no objection to a tighter title. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Representative Grimberg and then Gall.
Yeah, no, that was the issue. Peter and I have been looking at maybe a suggestion for a title that would narrow it. And Peter had suggested, and I think it's a good idea, an act relating to cooperation among school districts for administrative services.
Well, don't limit it just to administrative services. Don't make it so. The educational services, especially
educational and administrative, or something.
So you want to say and educational?
For educational and administrative services.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Okay. At the proper time, Mr. Chair, we'll entertain that motion. Representative Gall.
Is that because of the definition of educational that we need that in? I guess. Because it defines educational services. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Okay, is there anything further for Representative Copeland?
A motion?
No, we're not ready yet. Representative Copeland, if you'd like to join us at the table. Mr. Hull?
Would you like to join us at the table?
Sure.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Steve Hull from the Department of Education. Presently, Mr. Chairman, there's a statutory requirement that a school district select and employ a chief school administrator. It may be appropriate in the spirit of the discussion taking place here to amend that statute to permit a school district to contract with another school district for superintending services. Presently, it seems that school districts tend to view that requirement as being somewhat restricted. Additionally, the committee may want to discuss.
And excuse me, Mr. Rolls, that would not be included in the superintending services. I would think this is expansive enough to include that, but your reading would be that it wouldn't.
What I'm suggesting, Mr. Chairman, is that I agree with you. The services of a superintendent are probably covered under the definition in this statute. Mm-hmm. There is another statute that tends to contradict.
What is that statute?
1414. I'd have to look at the Title 14.
Okay, we'll get that for you.
May I just ask a question on this one, please, Mr. Chairman? Would the word thank you, Mr. Chairman. On line 11 of the bill, Steve, would you want to say, as well as dealing with the other statute here, would you want to say cooperate and contract?
Oh, I think cooperate includes contract.
Sure.
Okay.
Why?
At least the implication is.
I just want you to be satisfied. You're the guys who have to administer this.
There's one other issue, Mr. Chairman, that you may want to deal with, and that is there seems to be a growing trend for superintendents to take mid-year vacations, permanent vacations, leaving school districts in a lurch, if you will, for the services of a chief school administrator.
Thank you. Could you just explain what you're saying?
Yeah, a school district either fires a superintendent mid-year or the superintendent quits mid-year.
You didn't really mean vacation. I mean, you meant where the superintendent is terminated or terminates employment.
That's correct.
Leaves.
Thank you.
A situation arose a year or so ago in which a person in a community volunteered services as a superintendent. In my view, that's a poor practice. I think you get what you pay for, and I think it's a district runs a real risk in accepting volunteer services for a function as important and critical as chief school administrator. So you may want to deal with that either in this or a different bill. In my view, that ought not happen. In terms of your earlier discussion arising from the language in lines 11 and 12, there are a variety of circumstances under which the department may require districts to cooperate. Frequently it happens when district administrations don't talk to one another. For instance, years ago when the city of Sandpoint reorganized as a city of the first class, and in the process, of course, reorganized itself out of the Aleutian School District, there was a conflict between the respective boards of education and superintendents that precluded them from getting together and negotiating an orderly transfer of real property and other materials. In that instance, the threat of the department's authority to require them to get together was sufficient to have that effect. In the not-too-distant past, there was a situation in which we required the students in the Matanuskas who sit in the borough living closely proximate to the Rail Belt School District boundary to attend school in the Rail Belt School District. Simply because there was a school there, there wasn't one close to where the kids lived in the Matsu borough. We have required districts to provide transportation services for other school districts. There's a whole host of reasons for implementing this provision.
And Mr. Hull, under what existing authority did you make those you did exactly what this bill is giving you authority to do.
Amend that authority, Mr. Chairman. That exists presently in lines 11 and 12.
Mm-hmm.
And we just implemented that authority.
Mm-hmm. Representative Gall.
1440-130 dealing with the duties of chief school administrator. Is that what you're...
1440?
1414-130.
Is that the one that says the district shall select?
Each school board shall select and employ a qualified person as chief school administrator for the district.
That's the one.
What is it you want to change?
It seems to me that you ought to add language that permits contracting within another school district for those services.
Well, it just says they have to select and employ. You mean that you want to say or contract?
That's fine. Just to make it clear that it's possible for districts to go together and share administrative services.
Well, of course, there's no definition of employ, though. I mean, I'm employing you as a witness. You're employing me as a legislator, even though we don't have any corporate relationship. Do you think it really needs a language change?
I do, yes.
Thank you.
And What are the sanctions, Mr. Hole, for non-cooperation?
Withholding state aid. As a practical matter, Mr. Chairman, there is no sanction. The hollow threat that exists respecting a school district defying the department's order or refusing to obey a regulation or doing anything else we don't like is the withholding of state aid. And frankly, it's only as a last resort that we even contemplate that. From my perspective, it makes absolutely no sense to beat up on the instructional programs for children because of acts of an administration.
Do you have existing authority to withhold foundation formula aid in whole or in part?
Yes, 1407060, I believe, or 070.
Representative Gall.
Mr. Hole, I'm a little nervous about schools contracting superintendents. It seems to me that that would be a great thing for any school that wants to get out of paying benefits. Do we really mean each school board shall select and employ or contract with another school district for the services of? Mm-hmm. That's specifically what you're trying to get at. Contract
yes.
with another school district.
Yes.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Anything further from Mr. Hole? If not, at this time, I'll entertain a motion relating to amending the title. Representative Rumberg?
Mr. Chairman, are we going to be amending this other statute, 1414-130?
Well, we'll consider it.
My suggestion is that we not amend the
title
until we know what's going to be in the body of the bill. I'll make the motion of the appropriate motion at the appropriate time.
Okay.
Do you want an amendment?
Representative Gall.
Thank you. Do you want an amendment on the school administrator section 1414-130?
If you care to make one, we'll talk about it. Representative Gall.
All right. For purposes of discussion, I would move amendment number one to the effect that we add a section of the bill to amend Alaska Statute 1414-130 to read: each school board shall select and employ or contract with another school district for the services of a qualified person as the chief school administrator for the district. The new language would be, or contract with another school district for the services of.
Okay, the motion is before us, Representative Bloomberg.
It sounds like a good motion to me. I would prefer that, since this isn't a simple little deal, that we ask...
Consider it a conceptual amendment,
yeah,
Mr. Chair.
And ask the sponsor of the bill and the department to work with the drafters to make sure that it doesn't need anything else technically. I don't have any objection to the concept, though.
So moved.
I would have one.
Representative Kopanen?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Does that make your...
Is there anything that prohibits a school district now from contracting for other services, such as the business of management? We don't need any other changes to allow that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I wouldn't want to expand it.
So, Representative Copeland, you have no objection to the amendment or looking at it as a conceptual amendment?
Whatever works.
Is there any objection to the amendment? Hearing none, that would be incorporated. Representative Grunberg, are there any other amendments you care to make?
No, I would just ask that... that the Gall title amendment be considered at that time by the drafter. I'll give this to staff and have an appropriately narrow title.
Okay, well, let's go ahead and make the title amendment as a conceptual amendment. But
so moved.
Put some language on the record. Representative Gall, you want to restate the...
Here, I've got it right
here. Mr. Grunberg, make this motion.
Something to the effect an act relating to cooperation among school districts for educational and administrative services, or something to that effect that fits.
Okay, that's the motion before us, with the understanding that it should conform to the previous amendment. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection to the amendment? Hearing none, that will be worked on by the drafter as well.
Did we ever ask for unanimous consent or do anything to pass the First Amendment? Yes. Thank you.
Or are you going to?
If there's nothing further on House Bill 282, I'll entertain a motion to move the bill. Representative Gall?
Chairman.
With individual recommendations, the bill moves from committee. Representative Grunberg?
Just as a matter of courtesy, since we're going to have a CS, I would appreciate it if the staff, before it's read across, would just distribute copies to us so we can review it.
Sure, that's a reasonable request, and we will take care of it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Good legislation.
Yes.
Next item before us is House Bill 193. So the governor's bill, an act relating to vacancies on and reallocation of elective board seats in areas of the unorganized borough. Ms. Edgeworth, would you like to join us, please?
Maybe we can tack my little bill that you paid.
Which one is that?
Good morning. If you'd like to go ahead, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Linda Edgeworth with the Division of Elections. I'm very grateful that the committee has chosen to hear this bill. We had the opportunity to present a brief overview of it at the during the waning weeks of the legislative session last year. At that time, there were no real objections raised, but there were some questions that were left unanswered. And since it's been quite some time, I'd like to maybe just reiterate briefly what the bill is about. The current rural educational school board statutes and the coastal management resource area statutes related to the election process and the issues that result from various election procedures and practices are very, very loosely written. This bill attempts to clarify some of the procedures and make available remedies for certain problems that continue to exist and plague the election process for these types of elections. Basically, the bill does, in its current state, does about four things. Right now, the existing statutes for these school boards and for the coastal management areas have no statutory reference or guideline as to when newly elected officials are sworn into office. Now, that would seem obvious that once an election is certified, new officers should take office. In practice, there have been many circumstances, several recently, where because of other problems, undertones and undercurrents with which the Division of Elections is unfamiliar but are very meaningful with inside the communities and in the rural school districts themselves. New candidates who've been elected have not been sworn in because there is no deadline for such an activity. This bill attempts to remedy that in stipulating that the newly elected officers are sworn in at the first meeting following certification of the election. The second situation that occurs very, very frequently, more commonly in coastal resource service area elections than school boards, but certainly among the rural school boards as well, is that no one files for office and seats are left blank. That means that we are proposing blank ballots to areas of the state in which there are no candidates' names appearing on the ballot, and they have to very often nominate candidates as write-ins by section, which means that you can, and yet you elect at large in most school districts and coastal resource service areas, which means that you can receive a ballot for which you're supposed to write in a candidate's name from a community where you don't know anyone. It causes lots of confusion for voters, and it causes lots of certainly consternation for the Division of Elections trying to certify an election with names of communities written in the candidate box. If you'd like to see a couple of sample ballots, I could show you what they look like. This one happens to be, if the permission of the chairman, this one happens to be from 1987, but it's the Lower Yukon School District in which seat B had no candidates. The incumbent chose not to file for office, and no one else did either. In this particular school district, the candidates have to be nominated by sections, so you can see that the top seat has no candidate written in. The people who live in Hooper Bay, Scammon Bay, Russian Mission, Fortuna Ledge, are required to nominate someone for that seat from Malacanuck, Monarch, Kotlik, or Sheldon Point. And they don't know who to put in. As a result, we have spreadsheets that frequently look like this, where we have 1 and 2 and 3 votes cast for people where accidentally family, relatives, friends think somebody to be a good member of the school board, and so winners are selected out of an entire school district of 1,200 voters by 3-2 votes. The resignation rate is phenomenal. What this bill attempts to do is to solve this problem by saying that if there is no candidate filed for office at the closing deadline, The seat does not appear on the ballot. Rather, it is filled under existing statutes as a vacancy by the newly elected members of the school board. The advantages to that are many. Obviously, we eliminate circumstances like this, which we ended up with in two races in 1988, where there were 87 to 100 write-in candidates, each with two or three votes each. And so basically, it would say that the seat would not appear on the ballot. Instead, it would be filled as a vacancy and by the existing school board. The vacancy would be filled only for until the next regular election, at which time the seat would go on the ballot again, or at least the nomination would be open again for the unexpired term. The third thing that this bill does is we have existing circumstances that don't come up frequently, but frequently enough that it is a continuing problem in rural areas of the state, in these school boards primarily. And that is that there are certain areas of the state where population shifts occur dramatically, which means that right now the reapportionment plan happens after the census. The Commissioner of Education is required to reapportion the school districts. But as the years go by in a 10-year period, especially in Southeast where logging camps move across sectional borders, right now there is no way to remedy the alignment of seats on school boards when the when shifts in population result in over or under representation. We have several areas where this has occurred and there's been no remedy for it. This bill seeks to rely on the existing statutes that give the Commissioner of Education, in consultation with the Commissioner of Community and Regional Affairs, the opportunity to realign school districts if the census is more than 5 years old and if other statistical data, whether from Department of Labor or Community and Regional Affairs population estimates, would certainly show a substantial basis that the reapportionment is required to equalize representation among school boards, that they could do that, and that reapportionment plan would go into effect at the next regular election. Not to resection or remove boundaries, because moving boundaries when a school board is divided into sections is already allowable by petition from the people and put on the ballot before the voters. So that is one remedy. But in some geographic locations, the recasting of geographic boundaries doesn't make sense. There, it doesn't allow better representation or the appropriateness of the contiguous geographic areas, the common language and dialect requirements of reapportionment plans. So this would be an alternative method of realigning seats among school districts to establish equal representation when shifts in population make the existing reapportionment plan no longer valid. The only other thing that this bill does is make a consistency between Coastal Resource Service Area elections and school board elections, because the Title 46 provisions refers to Title 14, which is the education statutes covering rural school boards, and then they both tell us to rely on Title 29 and then back to Title 15. So this bill is designed to make them all consistent. So those are basically the three provisions of the bill as they relate to both Coastal Resource Service Areas and rural school boards.
Ms. Edgeworth, thank you for your presentation. Representative Grunberg and then Dahl.
What is a Coastal Resource Service Area?
Under the Coastal Management Program, it's like an advisory board that is elected by the voters in an area, and they make advisory decisions for coastal management planning through the Office of Governmental Coordination and through the Department of Community and Regional Affairs. I'm not totally familiar with all of their role in coastal management decisions. We are primarily responsible for the elections in those areas. Coastal management areas and REA school districts are related in that often they have common boundaries. However, a coastal resource service area can be made up of more than one rural educational attendance area.
And I have another question. As long as we're dealing with this type of problem, and not only in school districts, somebody told me about something that's very strange, that there's a type of ballot that is sent out, and I think it's sent out sometimes very early, maybe the service people, that just has all the names blank on it and just list the parties. What is that and where is that found? That strikes me as a very dangerous practice.
That particular bill was passed as part of House Bill 284 in 1986. And the purpose of this bill was to allow more time for the possibilities of people to vote absentee by mail when they are voting from outside the country or from APO or FPO addresses, when normal ballot mailing and printing time might prevent them from voting. They also get the regular ballot. So it's a special overseas advance ballot primarily for primary and general elections, and that's the only use of that ballot for overseas voters. And that was passed in by the legislature in 1986.
If I may, Mr. Chairman,
sure.
You say that they also get the regular ballot. Might they have already voted by the time they received the other ballot, or do they get it at the same time?
They don't get it at the same time. The special advance ballot for overseas voters goes out 60 days ahead of the election. The reason why it's blank, well, first of all, the primary election is handled a little differently than the general in that instance. The primary election ballot, special advance ballot, is accompanied by the complete list of candidates who filed for office. So they write in the names. But the ballots aren't, we haven't had time to print the ballots between the filing deadline and the 60-day advance mailing to overseas voters. They receive the regular ballot, and the federal or the special advance ballot is only open if it is the only ballot received back from the voter. If we receive the regular ballot back from the voter in time, the special overseas ballot remains sealed and is never opened. So it is only a safety gap measure if mail turnaround time prevents them from getting their ballot back to us in time.
Okay, well, for the primary, if I may, Mr. Chairman, the primary then, they get this blank ballot and a list of candidates.
Yes.
So they can write in and they know who's on there. I don't have a problem with that. How does it work in the general election?
In the general election, they also receive a list of all the people who have filed for the primary. They also get instructions that say, that alert them to the fact that not all of these candidates have advanced the general election ballot. At 60 days before the general election, we may not be finished certifying the primary, so we can't print names of winners because the election for the primary hasn't been certified. So as an alternative to that, if they don't want to take a chance of diminishing their vote by writing in the name of an individual who has not advanced the general election ballot, they have the choice of either taking that opportunity or to vote by party. If they vote by party, it means whoever, if they check the Democrat box, that whoever was the candidate on the general election ballot from the Democratic Party gets their vote. Again, that ballot is only counted if that's the only ballot received back. The regular ballot always has preference and priority. And so that is the one that's reviewed if we receive both from back and the other remains sealed. It is a safe gap measure because some foreign locations have such difficult time with mail turnaround time, it's the only opportunity for them to cast a ballot at all.
Representative Gall.
Now let me understand this. Say the primary is on August 27th or something, and the general election is on the 5th of November. So that means is that 8 days, is that right? And that's why it's a problem?
Actually, the general election ballots are fairly consistently mailed out, printed and ready to mail out about 3 weeks prior to the election.
Do I understand correctly that the primary might be around, say, August 27th and the general around November 5th, so you have about an 8-day time there that's available for you on getting out these foreign ballots?
That's correct. That's correct.
And how many of these ballots do you send out?
Actually, last year was the first opportunity to really use them after the 86 passage of the bill.
The bill required the 60 days as well?
Yes, for both primary and general elections.
And how many did you send out?
I think we sent out about 300 statewide.
Well, I could sit down myself at the table and handwrite 300 accurate ballots in 24 hours after the primary. So I just don't understand why this is being done. I think this is, we are not in a parliamentary system. This is absolutely contrary to giving people, you know, an accurate right to vote. This prejudices elections. I think this is just unbelievable. I don't know how it slipped my notice, I'll tell you, because this is just the kind of thing that manipulators of the process thrive on.
Actually,
I'm going to move that language be deleted from the statute.
Mr. Chairman, I'm concerned. I think that we need to deal with that problem. I was unaware of this until people told me. If I may ask one question, did you get any ballots back that were blank and simply had the parties checked?
Actually, very few of them were open and counted, and of course that was 1988, and I don't remember the specifics. I could certainly find that information for you. The vast majority of these voters, I believe it was like 70 or 80% of them, actually got their regular ballot back, and so the advance ballot was a mute issue. Obviously, this legislation was passed by the legislature. The interesting thing is that this is becoming a widespread practice wide across the country, because military and overseas voters are being disenfranchised strictly by the timing of mailing out ballots, and it's the only opportunity for them to vote, and it is only used as a safety gap measure in case the turnaround time does not allow them any other mechanism for voting.
I understand. I would, Mr. Chairman, this bill is on this subject. I don't know that we're going to have another bill like this. I would like to get a little more testimony on this, and I'd like to know how many actually came back blank. With it's basically simply like pulling a party lever, and that's something we've never done in this state, and I am concerned about that, if you may, Mr. Chairman.
Anyone else want to pose a question on that point? Representative Gall?
Well, only, Mr. Chairman, that I would also like to join Mr. Grunberg in requesting that the committee take this matter up. I think this is a very serious question. I have another amendment that I'd like to speak to or ask Ms. Edgeworth about.
Okay. We will ask Ms. Edgeworth if you could provide that information that Representative Grunberg requested, breakdown of the statistics.
Maybe we can have a short briefing informally at some point with the staff.
Sure. And Mr. Chairman, Ms. Edgeworth, I would like to get your recommendations. I didn't mean to suggest this was your idea or your problem. It's certainly our doing, and I'm just embarrassed that I didn't know what had happened. I would like to know what your positive recommendation would be for an alternative mechanism. I'll give you one. You can call me up and sit me down, and I'll volunteer to write ballots with you, and I'll do 300 a night. Maybe you could come up with something that fit more within the administrative procedures of our state. But I just cannot for a moment believe that we can't, in 10 days, turn out 1,000 copies of something. You can do it on a Xerox machine in 15 minutes. There's just something very wrong with the premise on which this is based, that we can't get from here to there. So I would appreciate your recommendations on how the division would like to get from here to there. I guess my second example is probably the best one. Maybe somebody with a typewriter types up one page, and then somebody goes to the Xerox machine and Xeroxes out 500 of these, and then we put them in envelopes and mail them out. That would seem like an idea to me, and it would have a fiscal impact maybe of about $50. Let's go for it. Let's come up with a recommendation to replace this.
We'll be more than happy to discuss recommendations. The real problem is that we can't certify the election until 15 days, at least 15 days after the election, because absentee ballots are still coming in. Mm-hmm. And so the certification process takes about 3 weeks, and we would be very hesitant to print an official winner's name on a candidate with absentee ballots not being certified.
Then it sounds to me as if we need to change that conflict in the statutes, that one says we're sending out ballots and the other says you have to wait 5 days after the deadline to do so. Maybe we need to hold our primary a week earlier. Something needs
Representative
to be done.
Representative Gall, as the staffer who worked on this legislation, I'll recognize Representative Boyer, who might want to
what is your historical knowledge?
I really don't want to spend a lot of time on this. I want to hear about the amendment that's in our packets and then hold the bill over so you all can have time to do whatever you need to do. Representative Boyer?
I would just like to say that I remember working on this bill 4 years ago, and if there's one thing that all of us are experts on, it seems to be elections, and it's a horror to have to bring any election bill forward because there's always something that we're stimulated by as legislators. But in my particular case, in my election, it was in general that this happened, but it could have easily have happened in a primary where it took 30 days and a recount, and you certainly don't have that window of opportunity between the primary and the general then to do what you're suggesting. So I would hate to see us tinker with it too much and disenfranchise people altogether, but I understand the concerns of the members.
Well, if I could, Mr. Chairman,
Representative Gall.
Thank you. Just to stimulate thought and then put it aside or defer to Mr. Grunberg, maybe then what I'm very concerned about is this situation where you have folks who are essentially in confinement far away from America under control of a particular political party's leadership, having to vote on the basis of party. And I guess one answer to that, if we're looking for compromise, might be that all of those names should be down there and they have the right to vote maybe for, I mean, I guess if they could check all the names of one party and say whichever one won, that's okay with me, at least they've taken it upon themselves to indicate those are the names that you can choose from, whoever it is who won that list. But to essentially have them just check a party, I don't like it. I'd like to pursue it and find some way to make it better, even if we can't totally fix it.
For the general election, Mr. Chairman, each race allows them the option of writing in a specific person's name or voting by party in that particular race. It isn't a blanket party ballot where they just vote once. I mean, we did break it down by every single race having the option allowed to them.
Okay. I'd like to ask that you all take care of those kinds of comments back and forth in your briefing from the division.
Just for the record, I'm not concerned about the primary particularly because you send them the list. I'm concerned about the job.
All right. That's clear. Are there any other questions for Ms. Edgeworth on the other parts of the bill, the proposed amendment? Representative Gall?
I've got a quick question, and then sure. We'd like to discuss the amendment that was requested by the Office of the Governor. Ms. Edgeworth, I wrote down on page 2, under the first amended section there, on line 6, I wrote, reallocation of seats or establishment of section boundaries must be justified on the basis of maximizing equal representation. A few times and read your language a few times, I sort of don't really want to add any new language. Instead, I'd like to refer back to line 2, where it says, beginning on the previous page, if the census is 5 years old or older and other reliable population data, and this is the key phrase, establishes that board members do not represent as nearly as practicable. Then it goes on, it says, equal numbers of people under the allocation of seats, the commissioner may reallocate. Well, if it has been determined that, in fact, as it states on line 29, page 1, the board members do not represent as nearly as practical equal numbers, why are you giving the commissioner discretion to reallocate? Why shouldn't it say the commissioner shall reallocate seats in order to achieve as nearly as practical equal representation? I mean, it seems to be here that if some director or commissioner decides that it's in the party's interest to avoid this, then they have the right to, for political reasons, avoid this act. I just think, basically, yeah, it should say, shall, and the thing that makes it tricky, though, is it says, may reallocate the seats if reallocation will achieve, so I would think it should say the commissioner shall reallocate the seats to achieve as nearly as possible equal representation, and the as nearly as possible takes care of any, you know, impossibilities that he might come up with. So, could you comment at all on that?
I would defer to the Department of Education on that particular on that particular recommended change. I think that the wording was really developed on the basis of how these circumstances are brought to our attention, and so that's why I think it was left more open. For the most part, it is usually concerned citizens, petitioners, school board superintendents who note the changes and bring them to our attention in the first place, mm-hmm. rather than something we actively go pursue.
Right.
And so I think that's why it was left as may, because we may not know about it.
No, it doesn't say that. It says on the prior line, I mean, forgive me, it says, if other reliable population data establishes that board members do not represent. So after you get your complaint, you go and you look at your reliable data. Having looked at your reliable data, you now have agreed that there's a problem.
The Division of Elections would have no objection to that change.
Thanks, sir. Appreciate it.
Mr. Hull?
Mr. Chairman, I'm Steve Hull from the Department. There are a couple of issues that may impinge on the decision the commissioner has to make under this section. The last time this issue came up, there were arguments over the allocation of seats, I believe, in the Southeast Island School District, which is that large area to the south that comprises logging camps and a variety of other kinds of communities. There were several different reliable sources of data. The labor had some, the Department of Labor had some, the school district had some. It becomes a question of whose data is more reliable than someone else's. The other problem is the statute may be mandatory, that is, it may require the commissioner to reallocate seats, but we still have to go through preclearance with the Department of Justice, and there may be Voting Rights Act issues that forestall a reallocation of seats. The other issue is we may be within 6 months or a year of a new census, and then the question is, do we rely rely then on non-census data and reallocate seats, or just wait a year when we will have data that everybody agrees is reliable? So it's more than just an issue of looking at something which is clear on its face without anything that confuses the issue, because once you get past the census data, there are lots of different data sources.
Representative,
well, why don't you craft the language then? After you have gone through whatever hoops you want to go through, when you've decided that there's a problem, just the way it says here, establishes that board members do not represent as nearly as practicable equal numbers of people. Is there some point when we can ask the department to do something and expect it to be done? And if so, when is that point? And let's get the language in here, because what this says is after you've decided there's a problem, you can act if you want. And that just doesn't make sense to me, Steve. I mean, if you don't like the basis which triggers the action, make it stricter. But once you've decided that there's a problem, I think it's time to act. Could you comment on
it? I think that he's just concerned that this is just a little too loose.
Well, let's tighten it up, but it's not a discretionary thing.
Yeah, I mean, that was your concern.
Mr. Hall, would you like time to think about that? We are going to hold the bill over for further discussion and entertain possible amendments at the next meeting. Or at the next hearing, not necessarily the next meeting.
Mr. Chairman, I'd be glad to look at it and see if I can come up with something. I guess what I'm suggesting is I'm not persuaded that it's something that has an absolute trigger.
Right. I'm not persuaded that protecting the discretionary actions of the commissioner are germane here. This has to do with equal protection under the law for the voters once it's been established that the boundaries do not provide equal protection. And I guess, sir, what I would like to officially ask the department to provide us is the language that they would prefer that requires that these boundaries be readjusted when the cause is demonstrated. And if you don't like this statement of cause, come up with one, please, that you do like. But I think it's specifically contrary to the public interest to suggest that boundaries will not be adjusted when the cause has been demonstrated. And if there is question about the reliability of the cause, I'll certainly defer to the tightest language possible, you know, but of course within the realm of reason. So at some point a decision has to be made. And that's all I'm saying. I want the department to decide what it feels is necessary to make a decision, but at that point to indicate that it's going to make a decision and not that maybe 5 years down the line it will make a decision. Because then that brings in the opportunity for tremendous political pressure.
Mr. Gold, did you have any other points?
Yeah. There's an amendment requested by the Office of the Governor that's in members' packets. Deals with vacancies. I can speak to it, or Linda can speak to it.
Okay, Ms. Edgeworth, would you like to speak to the amendment that's in our packets?
This particular amendment was first brought to our attention by several circumstances that happened in this last several months, and we received a request from Senator Eliason, and this is and based on his request, we proposed this kind of an amendment. Basically, because of the looseness of the REA statutes and the CRSA statutes, there is no language that gives guidance to under what kinds of circumstances seats can be declared vacant so that they can be filled under the normal procedure by appointment. The two circumstances that come most immediately to mind is that, again, in the Southeast Island School District, a candidate for office happened to be an employee of the school district. When she ran for office, she defeated the incumbent candidate. After she was certified the winner of the election, she decided she did not want to quit her job at the school district, and there are provisions that say you can't be an employee of the school district and sit on the school board, and she chose not to do it. And so she was never sworn in to office. In trying to determine how to respond to that, since that we did have a certified winner of election, we had to look for remedies. Do we reconduct the election? Do we give it to the next vote getter? Do they fill by appointment? We found that there was nothing in statute that solved the problem. Another circumstance happens to be in the REA 22, Kashanumiat, where one of the school board members, we got a phone call from another school board member, said he'd left the area, his family, and he had relocated outside the school district. and there is no remedy for determining his seat or our official method of declaring the seat vacant. So in trying to determine, yes, there are lots of circumstances under which a seat might be determined vacant. We researched other statutes and referred to the Title 29 statutes for municipal officers and borrowed the language from that particular statute for being proposed to this one. And the vacancies, we're trying to fill some holes here. So in the case of RE19, the only thing we could rely on is the stipulation that says that school board members serve for 3-year terms and until the successor takes office. Since the successor never took office, the defeated incumbent remains in the seat indefinitely. So we borrowed from the municipal code to establish rules that would allow seats to be declared vacant for other reasons. When someone leaves the area and doesn't come back and never writes and never shows up to meetings, is that a legitimate reason why the board member should be able to declare the seat vacant? If a person fails to qualify, if they're duly elected and fail to qualify to hold the office, should the school board have the discretion of declaring the seat vacant? If the person notifies the school board in writing that they refuse to be sworn in, as the person in REA-19 did, should the school board have the option of being able to declare the seat vacant so they can get a viable replacement to serve the school's needs? So that's what this amendment is all about, to provide other mechanisms. It's borrowed directly from the municipal title. There are some things that I want to apprise you of in researching this. The municipal title provides these methods of declaring an official seat vacant, but excludes the mayoral race and school board members. I talked with Tam Cook, who was actually responsible for writing Title 29 when it was recodified a couple of years ago, to ask why those exclusions were made. She said that the best of her recollection was that they were left out of this because they were covered under separate sections under their own, the mayor's responsibilities, and so declaring the mayoral seat vacant reiterates this provision under the mayoral section. I found it missing from Title 29 School Board for municipal school boards. When I asked her if there was a purpose in that, she told me that it was strictly an omission. She thought it should be added to Title 29, and she thought it was certainly appropriate to add it to the school board, rural school boards. So we decided that we would borrow from the language of Title 29 as a remedy and insert it in this bill, since this bill does deal with vacancies on rural school boards. The amendment also covers coastal resource service area boards who can come up with the same difficulties and problems.
Thank you. When this bill is back before us, we will consider the amendment in our packets number one. Representative Grunberg and then Gall.
With respect to amendment number one, Ms. Edgeworth, I absolutely understand what you're doing here. This first section sounds reasonable. And I understand what you're doing. Yeah, I think I understand what you're doing. On the second thing here, it's on page 2, line 26. What you're doing, you're going to be adding that language here, and you're going to be referencing 1412070. It's just going to simplify the trail.
That's true.
My problem is in the very last portion here, the repealer. And it's a technical question, Mr. Chairman. And you have to look at the statute here. AS 1408041 deals with regional school boards. Subsection E reads as follows. A vacancy on a regional school board shall be filled in accordance with AS 1412070. If you repeal that and you don't have anything else in that statute that says how it's to be filled, then there's no law on how it should be filled. I do think you should leave that in.
Mr. Chairman, the purpose of repealing that was because we were creating a whole new section dealing with vacancies. So we took it out of the general section on regional school boards and put it as item B under the proposed amendment. So it's just for clarification of the statute, keeping all the vacancy issues together.
I see. Okay, then I don't have any problem with that. That's good. Thank you.
The words after that. Okay. Representative Gall, why don't you go ahead and address Mr. Hull on the record.
generally accepted.
Words. I don't want to get, Mr. Chairman, the amendment I gave Representative Gall adds as a modifier undisputed to the description census data. Trivial as it may sound, the fact that we could likely end up in a salvo arguing over the verity of who's got the data is very real. And I don't want to end up with a party moving against the commissioner to make a change on the basis of his data and someone else having data that says something to the contrary. I think it's absolutely in the public's interest that there is undisputed data that shows there's a way to fix it. We ought to fix it.
Well, I'd like to suggest this, Mr. Chairman. I very, very much appreciate what you're saying, Steve, really. And it's not my intent to create a situation for the department that would require it to do a readjustment, for example, after an election and 3 months before the census figures come in or any of the circumstances that would just create trouble for you. Likewise, I wouldn't want to see you be forced to take action on data that wasn't, let's say, generally accepted. What I'd like to do is, if the chairman is planning to not move this bill today, to work with you and just make sure we reach language that you're happy about on reflection and also achieve the purpose of ensuring.
The amendment I give you, I think.
Okay.
That's what I think.
Well, then let us work with that language and see where it goes in the committee. I thank you very much. Mr. Chairman, do you want me to move this amendment that we can discuss?
No, we are going to take all amendments at the markup session on February 21st, Wednesday of next week.
I'd like your advice.
We'll have the bill back before us. If more time is needed, we'll take it since we are the only committee of referral. But I would hope to have it back then and have amendments in writing to the committee staff. And we'll be acting as a subcommittee of the whole since Representative Boyer is correct. Everybody has to... Everybody's an expert, and everybody has to. We have to achieve some sort of consensus in this committee to move this along.
When would this be back?
How about
an idea?
Next week at some point. Reliable population data.
Is there an
act to the department?
Wednesday, February 21st.
Because then you can judge the data.
I said that. I may have just missed. Representative Gall, did you have another comment?
Yes, sir. I just want to put on the record. I just was speaking with Mr. Holland, and although there hasn't been any positive decision here, another language that I think might be acceptable, and the department thinks might be acceptable, is to say other population, reliable population data acceptable to the department establishes the board members do not represent. That way the department has the opportunity to pass on the reliability of the data, but once it has judged the data to be reliable, then it would be compelled to take action.
I think that's excellent.
Okay. So that might be a way around.
It's a good suggestion for an amendment. I would like to, we're not going to have a committee substitute for this bill. No, we're going to work with the original bill and have discrete amendments before us so that people can see them very clearly and not just adopt a committee substitute that will come back to haunt us later when questions arise on the floor.
Martin.
Exactly. Ms. Edward, thank you for being with
us.
Well, before you go, is there anyone else who wanted to testify on this bill? No, I'm getting negative hand signals.
Sweet.
Ms. Edward, thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
Is there any further business to come before us this morning?
What's that?
If not, we'll adjourn the meeting at 9:41 a.m.
Yeah.